Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Soul Seekers podcast, where we believe that hunting has the power to transform lives through primal adventure as we share our mission of mentorship is conservation. To learn more about everything we do, check out our show on Carbon TV or go to soulseekersnation.com. Freedom on, everybody, and stay soulful. Do you love America? Do you love supporting American manufacturing? If the answer is yes, then check out Coltac gear for Made in America products with a lifetime warranty. Coltac manufactures specialty gear designed for long-range shooting, hunting, and other tactical applications. From their support bags, suppressor covers, their new bino harness, and a whole lot more, Coltac is creating tough, durable, and innovative gear for serious shooters. Go to Coltac.com to see all that they have to offer, and use the code SOULSEEKERS10 to save 10% at checkout. If you are wanting to become more accurate and deadly with your shooting, one of the best things you can do is upgrade your trigger with a Timney. Timney triggers are 100% made in America and have been since their founding, providing a crisp, reliable, and repeatable trigger break every time. I'll be shooting Timney triggers in my guns this year, and I hope you'll join me in shooting the world's finest trigger. Go to TimneyTriggers.com to get yours today. If you're looking to take your hunting to another level, there's no better way to do it than by subscribing to Onyx Hunt. If you want to get better at hunting and go deeper into your scouting, Onyx is the number one GPS app for that. Join the millions of hunters who trust Onyx Hunt to find more game, discover new access, and hunt smarter. If you want to know more about Onyx, go to onyxmaps.com/hunt or download their app today for a free trial. As a school teacher of 20 years, safety has always been a top priority. So when it comes to shooting and hunting, it's no different for me, which is why I always prefer to shoot suppressed. Huxworks Safety Company is a human exposure workshop dedicated to building products that are optimized for the safety and health of their customers without compromising efficiency or performance. If you're not shooting suppressed, what are you waiting for? Go to huxworks.com to start protecting your health and future today. That's huxworx.com. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of the Soul Seekers podcast. I'm your host, Johnny Mack, and today's guest is a pretty cool and amazing story all in itself. We have a musician turned entrepreneur who holds some speed records, has some military tech innovator and revolutionizing firearm safety, got into hunting later in life as an adult, and had his life transformed through the primal adventure that it provides. And we're just going to be talking all things outdoors, hunting, and connecting the dots for all of you. So thanks for tuning in to this episode. My brother, Tom, thanks for coming on the show, brother.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I read through the sheet on the show. I'm just like, this is really interesting. It's a different kind of podcast.
Yeah. I like to say we spread the gospel of hunting here.
There you go. That's a decent way to look at it. There's a connection that you can't get elsewhere.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize it until later in life. And all of a sudden it becomes, you find your whole year hinges around, 17 days of whitetail season or.
My wife and I, we are going on 13 years of marriage this June. And I met her 13 years ago. This love at first sight. Walked in, locked eyes. I was like, oh yeah, that's going to be my bride as long as conversation lines up. Well, at that time, my life goal and plan trajectory was to be a head football coach. And so That was one of these things that I was, being like, all right, listen, I want to marry you, but you're going to be a football widow if you sign up for this. Like, just, I want that to be known so that you're not holding anything against me later on or, all that. Well, I bait and switched her, and I switched out coaching football for hunting, and the story goes on. But
I hunt mornings every day in hunting season and in whitetail season. I'm out in mornings, and I'm usually home. My hunting property is 12 minutes from my house, so I live close to where I hunt. I usually hunt, I hunt till 11 o'clock on Saturdays and come home. Then I might go out for an evening, but most of my hunting is morning. There's just more deer. The activity of my deer is better. So it's not horrible. I don't disappear for days on end, unless I'm doing a booked, you know, a planned trip.
Yeah, I love it. Well, you've had quite a few different journeys in your life, from starting multiple companies and getting into racing and setting records on salt flats to climbing mountains and all that. So I'd be really interested to hear, because one of the things on this podcast is we're all about becoming better people. If you yep. tune into this podcast, you're searching to sharpen yourself, right? Another swipe of the whetstone to keep your edge and maintain yes. it. And everything that you have done on your resume of things in life have all been centered around making sure you have a strong mindset. Go ahead. Where did you create that foundation?
I call it single point focus. And that's what I strive for. There's athletes that use the term flow, where you're in the zone. And I hope everybody's experienced that. It's not easy to achieve, but there are moments when you're doing things where time almost stops and you become hyper aware of every tiny little thing. You know, the best example that I can give on that, you know, I raced RX-7s in the 90s with SCCA, and I was in a difficult race, first and second place, and we're battling. And when you race a car, it's not, you know, white knuckle, how fast can you go around the turn? It's a very structured, to drive fast, it's, you know the track, brake point, turn point, on a throttle, exit point. You drive down the straightaway, next brake point, and you're mapping this track out, and then you're executing the map. And as you're going, you're moving your brake points as close as you can to the turn to carry as much speed. And then as the track conditions change, you might change your brake point of all of a sudden, you know, that's how you drive fast. So I get to the end of this race, and I won the race on the very last lap. It was a really good race. And I always sit in the car after the race or sit on the hood, and I just kind of just think and reflect back at the race. You know, these races, SCCA races, are about 22-minute races. And I go back through, what did I do right? What did I do wrong? What, you know, what was there any major things? And I was thinking about the race down the main straightaway. I mean, these cars, it's not a long straightaway. Maybe you're going 85, 90 miles an hour. My turning point was a drop of oil on the track. There's no way I could see a drop of oil if I'm driving on a freeway at 75 miles an hour. I'm not going to see a drop of oil. But in the heat of that battle, you're so hyper-focused. It's like, there's my drop. Boom, brakes, turn. And it was, you get that dialed in. And that's, you know, why race cars? To get to that point. Rock climbing. When you're in a, yeah, I did the north face of Mount Athabasca. It was 2,000 feet of ice. It was a big wall of ice. And for the hours on that climb, you're unaware that you've got a business or you've got bills to pay or you've got a job. You're just, all it is you, these two hand tools, some crampons on your feet, and you're on that wall. It's just, and then you get done and the rest of the world kind of comes back in, but you've got a new perspective. You know, the rest of your world comes back and he's like, wow, you get done, you kind of exhale, and you're like, damn, that was something. And you're hiking down, you get back, and the next morning you're just like, you go back to your life, but you got something you didn't have.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is, but it's definitely there.
Yeah. You know, as a father, I really struggled with this, is being present in the moment. Right? The movie Last Samurai.
They talk about
too many minds. Nice. Focus.
Yeah.
I think women
much more naturally, that's their state, in a more natural way. Guys are, I mean, it's possible that we are always looking out for threats. You go back the way we evolved, it's possible that we're just, we've always got our guard up to look out for threats. And it's so hard to pause and just, again, when the kids were little, man, be in that moment. Mm-hmm. It's hard to do.
Yeah. And that was one of the things that, other than rock climbing, because I used to rock climb quite a bit in my day, hunting was the only thing that I had to. Well, I mean, I competed at sports in a high level, but you could also have sideline conversations and other things when you're coaching or playing. But hunting, if you want to hunt and be successful, especially like big game Western style hunting, you have to be committed and focused completely, and to really dive into that wholeheartedly rather than being like, ah, you know, maybe I'll just take a walk today and, you know, see what I stumble upon, which there's nothing wrong with that. But if you treat everything like it is that full on, you're training for an end goal, an end destination. And what is that goal? Keeping that in mind, that is something that really allows you to sharpen yourself and hone your skills.
Yeah. Well, does it just take us back to, there's a primal side of humans, you know, how we evolved. Because I find that when you're hunting, you know, I can go to the store and buy all the meat I want. Mm-hmm. But there's something about proper ethical hunt. You know, there's a high level of respect for the animals, for the land, for everything. But there's something about it that I have a hard time putting in words. People always ask me about it. It's just like, it locks you, it grounds you. It just takes you back to who we are.
Yeah.
You know, you just plant you in the ground. You know, the other side though is, you know, I spend a lot of time in tree stands and I've got, you know, some big like redneck blinds. If the weather's really blowing hard, I'm going to blind, but I much prefer to be in a high open stand. And I get up and, you know, you're in the dark. I'm up there. It can be brutally cold, but if you got the gear and you sit silently and watch the forest wake up. Mm-hmm. And people who haven't done that have no idea, like where I live, as you just get a hint of light, the mice are out. And there's one mouse every 12 feet. That's about their territory for about 10, 15 minutes. And they kind of disappear. Then the red squirrels. And then you're hearing different birds coming in, and the red squirrels are there. They'll climb right up on your feet. They're really active, and then they kind of just, and then gray squirrels. But there's this whole orchestration of the planet waking up. And my first 2 years hunting, I'd bring a cell phone with me in the stand, and I'd find myself sitting there, you know, looking at stuff on my phone. And it just occurred to me, saying, why am I doing this? So I do have a phone when I hunt for safety reasons. I keep it, you know, I've got a tracker, which I park. I've got some, you know, it's in the vehicle. I do not bring a phone with me to the stand.
Yeah.
My wife wishes I did, but I don't anymore, because when I do, I find myself going to it. Mm-hmm. You know, but if I don't have it, I'm forced to sit there for 3 hours and not make a sound. And your senses just open up, and there's just so many neat things that happen in a forest that you're never, just walking quietly with your wife through the woods is different than sitting in total silence.
Yeah.
You're just picking up on stuff.
Well, in today's modern society of the constant buzz and instant access and instant gratification, mm-hmm. it's very rare for people to actually be comfortable being alone, right? Because we're never alone nowadays, it seems like.
No. That is that's a real problem, I think, for a lot of young people now, is that constant dopamine hit of input from a screen or from, the one thing I'll do with my kids is, and it always snaps them out of it, is have them mow the lawn. The drone of a mower. When you like a push-by mower, even a riding mower, but when you're if I'm on a tractor, like up on the property, the drone of a motor, you throw headphones on if you want, but that constant hum clears your head of everything, and your thoughts can just wander. It's kind of like, you know, when I was younger, I always found when I was taking a shower, just the gray noise of the shower, I'd get my best creative ideas just sitting there in the shower in the morning. Because I think it's not that you've got this grace or pink noise sound. It's that you're masking all of the little inputs. Yeah. And you're in a small shower. It's just the whole world is right there and there's no input. I've thought about getting one of those like sensory deprivation tanks mm-hmm. and just try. I've never done it. You know, but there's a real appeal to that.
Yeah. Yeah. Very true. I like to go running without headphones. I just go take a run and then be alone in my thoughts.
Yeah. I can't wear headphones when I'm out. For me, it's like, if I'm out in public, I want to be able to hear. I see people like my daughter's out with headphones. I'm just like, how can you not want to know?
Yeah.
The sounds around you.
Oh yeah. Well, we're not going to segue there yet, but that's a beautiful segue into how you even started your company Secure. Kind of always, you know, being aware of like what's going on around you. One of the things I want to go back to is when you were talking about your racing, and you were talking about, you know, having to focus and be in the flow. I just on social media the other day, I was watching some videos of the, I don't know what the type of racing it is. They're on motorcycles. It's like Grand Prix, but for motorcycles and these racers.
GTT or GTP. Yeah, that's a.
Yeah, all these racers were visualizing the race and all the turns prior to the race. They're sitting in chairs and their hands are on imaginary handlebars and they're leaning and they're turning and they're hitting the throttle. And what I really understand is like a lot of high performing people in this world really practice visualization.
Oh, absolutely.
Talk a little bit about your experiences with that.
Well, I'll give you an example of the power of it, though. Like when I raced, when I was really active racing the RX-7, I would always run and visualize. And there's a lot of studies. There's the basketball study real quick where they had three groups of people. They all threw free throws and got their percentage of accuracy. One group didn't practice. The other group practiced for 20 minutes a day. And the third group sat and visualized throwing baskets for 20 minutes a day. After 30 days of doing that, they retested it. The team that didn't practice didn't change. The team that practiced 30 minutes a day improved. The team that just visualized it improved almost they're just shy of the level of improvement of the team that actually improved. So visualizing works. But when I was racing, like Willow Springs Raceway, I could sit down in a chair and somebody say, go. And I would just sit there, close my eyes. I could do a lap of the track and I'd say, stop. And I'd be within a second of my lap times. Hmm. I mean, it's amazing how accurate you can get.
Yeah.
I'm a musician. I was a professional guitar player for 12 years and I was a practice-aholic. And I really broke into the science of how we learn, how to use repetition properly. But I also realized I live 27 minutes from my office on average. And during that time, I don't just practice silently. Like if you see a presentation, if I'm delivering a speech, typically I deliver a 27-minute speech because I leave my driveway and I start talking out loud in the truck. And I don't write my speeches. I start talking to all that doesn't work. And as long as if I got a speech to do in 30 days, I'll have it nailed. No papers, no nothing. I do that all the time. I take difficult questions. Like I know that are coming and I sit and say, okay, how would I answer that? And I answer it out loud or the company talking points. I'm talking to myself out loud. Nowadays they just think you're talking to your cell phone, but I use that 27 minutes to and from work every day to absolutely rehearse what I need for my life in terms of communication skills.
Yeah. I will say that I am a huge proponent of speaking out loud. And very often, you know, whether it starts with just affirmations, right? Like we have to get outside of our head. Yes, we need to visualize it, but we need to also create it. And that comes with the spoken word. You know, God said, you know, let there be light. He didn't think let there be light. He spoke it. And that's
church. If you go to churches, they're repeating passages out loud for a reason.
Yeah.
There's a lot of power in that.
Yeah. I love it. So when it came from being a professional musician to racing to mountaineering and ice climbing, what has this high level of, I'll say competition, because even when you're climbing, you're competing against yourself and against the mountain.
Yeah.
What has that done for you? And how do you see that benefit you in all aspects of life?
Well, confidence probably is the easiest answer because I don't do these things because I'm like some crazy adventure. I just see something that's fascinating and I want to learn. I want to know what it's like. Like you can read books and watch movies about mountain climbers. I want to know what it's like to actually be, you know, have 800 feet under your heels. I want to know what that feels like. So In climbing, I was fortunate enough. My business partner's boyfriend was one of Britain's top mountaineers, and I trained for 6 months, seven hard training before I did that climb because I knew I wasn't in that kind of in climbing shape, and that's a different kind of a shape than other things. But during that climb, I got to the we got, you know, he was ahead of me, 2,000 feet. He's a very good climber. I'm behind him. He tops out and I'm coming up. And normally he'd belay me at the top of the mountain with a rope. So if, you know, that's just how it works. So if I fall, he's got me. Instead, he just kept walking, which is, I mean, it's safe as well because, you know, I'm if I fall, he's got me. So he, I'm climbing and he's walking up this peak of this mountain over towards the actual peak. There was a lot of snow up there. It was windy. And when I, and he had walked off at about a 45 degree angle. I get to the top of the ice and I've got about a foot of rock coming out over the, about to the middle of my head and then rounding over. And that's the, that's like a ledge on the top. And the rope is going at a 45 degree angle. So I'm sitting there. I go, if I fall, I'm going to swing about 160 feet, maybe 200 feet into a wall of rock and ice. I'm going to hit hard enough where I will not be able to do anything. Mm-hmm. The rope will be coming on a cornice of ice and I'll be dangling. Kevin would have to deadlift me over a cornice, which really is pretty much impossible. You're not going to get a body over an ice cornice. You just, they, it just snags. You can't do it. I'm going, if I fall, this is a non-survival moment. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting right there and I started getting a little nervous, not bad, just on, but a voice, I never had it happen before me before, just as clear as a bell, just said, it's worth it. Just like that. It's worth it. And I stopped and I just thought for a minute about where I was. I had a little Minolta film camera. This is before digital, in my pocket that I could operate with one hand. I pulled it out. I snapped two photos over my shoulder of the view, put it back, reached up with one of the ice axes over my head, dragging it on this ledge, and it caught on a chip of stone. I'm like, all right. So I committed the other one. Now, if these things slide, I'm not going to be around. I had to walk my feet up so I could pull myself over the ledge. The farther I walk up, the greater the load. I'm, you know, I'm cantilevered. And boom, I got up, and everything worked out. And that's the last time I was ever afraid of anything in my life. I mean, there were, as a kid, I went through, I was afraid of speaking. I had a lot of stuff that you're afraid to do. And that's the last time that I've been afraid for my kids when they get in dangerous situations, things, but not, fear has never been a, I don't have it. I have understanding, but it's not something I didn't share with my wife. I didn't talk to anybody about it. I just kind of went through life like, all right, I'm good. And it was a huge change for me.
How did that shift your outlook moving forward?
I don't know if it shifted my outlook as much as I operated. When you operate with greater confidence, you get better results. Because people, it's not that unspoken communication. When you've got total confidence in what you're doing, people buy in. Mm-hmm. People just buy in. I mean, it has to be credible. It has to be what I'll use, spirit of intent, meaning your core intention in a conversation has to be noble, has to be good. Because it's like a shyster, a really good shyster salesman. No matter how good they are, you kind of know they're a shyster. But a genuinely sincere salesman or someone who really believes in what they're doing and believes that this benefits you is going to be much more effective. And it's just that, so I don't know. I think people respected me more, and they didn't even know what I was doing. It's just because of how I carried myself. Mm. If that makes sense.
Yeah. What do you think about the law of attraction?
I'm sorry?
Law of attraction. So like we naturally attract to ourselves what we're thinking, what we're feeling. And
I don't know. I don't know if I've experienced that really. I don't know. I tend to gravitate towards characters. I have very short patience for idle chat, for small talk. I mean, I don't make small talk. I don't like to go to corporate events and mixers and networking events. I can't stand that stuff. I'd rather have a meaningful conversation about a difficult topic. Like, don't talk politics. Why not?
Yes.
It's so fascinating. You know, I've got an uncle that he and I are on the opposite side of the world. And we love to debate because we're both good at it. We both respect each other. And it's we have so much fun. Be like, oh, guys, don't talk. Why not? It's like we're in a world now where people are so afraid of offending that nobody's willing to have a conversation about a challenging topic. And I'm just like, it's okay to be offended. There's nothing wrong with being offended or taking offense. Or offend. I mean, as long as it's done respectfully, and at the end, again, right now, you get in any kind of conversation that tracks in these directions, and people get emotional. They get threatened because of, you know, I've heard the identity. They identify their who they are with their belief, and that's such a horrible thing. And that's social media. That's the way the world is now. Young kids. All right, they identify everything they believe is part of who they are. No, it's just what you believe, man. You should be able to sit in a room, have a conversation with people that absolutely disagree with your core beliefs.
Yeah.
In a way, with a cup of coffee and a smile. And it's just gone.
Yeah. We are all human beings at the end of it. I will say back in, like 4 years ago, I did an episode saying, titled, "What You Do Is Not Who You Are." Right? Because that's identity politics, exactly what you're talking about is like, you know, hey, Tom, introduce yourself. Hi, I'm Tom. I'm such and such. I do such and such. You know, it's like, well, I am who I am. I am, and I show up as a leader, as a father, as a, you know, and how I operate, what I do is A, B, and C. It's really interesting. And I love that you say, you know, we got to be able to talk about things. I'm a social studies school teacher. So, talking about freedom of speech, America hangs its hat on it, right? Before we talk about Second Amendment and firearms and guns and all that awesome stuff, it starts with communication. And that goes back to what we talked earlier about speaking out loud, right? We got to get out of our heads. We got to have dialogue. We have to sharpen each other and see the world from these different perspectives. A diamond is only beautiful and only radiates the light because of the different facets it has, rather than it just being one direction, one perspective the entire time. I will also say that I loved how you were talking about getting out and having experiences, because in this world, when we're talking politics, whether we're talking the defense of hunting, how that's being under attack constantly, is everyone has an opinion, which is just a talking head repeating something that they heard somewhere else. And not many people will go through an experience. An experience creates perspective.
Yeah, that's it. And I don't care what your resolution is on your iPad, you're not getting an experience with a screen.
Yeah.
It's not. That's, you have to be at risk. And it doesn't have to be dangerous risk. But you're always, when you're just going out in public, you're at risk. There's always interactions that could make you uncomfortable. Everything we do publicly, socially, there's a level of risk.
Yeah.
Now, we live in a society where the level of risk is extremely low. But as you up your game and doing other things, the risks can happen. But there's more and more people that, you know, they raise their kids to always avoid risk, or, you know, the what they call that, helicopter snowplow parents, whatever those things are, where they're so worried about the kids getting hurt. The kids are growing up with no ability to evaluate actual risk.
Right.
You know, and that kills leadership.
Well, because I want to talk about that, but I fight this with my wife all the time. We have three boys. I need my boys. Their goal is to be a man. And to be a successful man, they have to learn and engage through touch and feel and experience. So I'm like, hey, go climb that tree and figure it out. Well, they could fall out of it, Mom. You know, Mom, like, don't hurt yourself. It's like, go scrape your knee. Figure it out.
It's yes, they could. And that's, but the level of confidence when they come down, it might not be huge, but it's still there. They did it. It's especially if they're a little scared and they push it. And they, again, that's a personal thing. They deal with themselves. We all as kids and we're all as adults go through situations where I'm not really comfortable with this, but I'm going to go ahead and just work it anyhow. And you're like, yeah, it wasn't so bad. I mean, how many times you do something that you're worried about and you realize hindsight is like, man, I was worried about that. You feel silly for even doing it.
Oh, yeah. My first, when I got into hunting, I was a high school football coach, and football started August 16th. In the first 2 weeks, I would always go backpacking, go fishing, and just be out in the mountains. I was deathly afraid of bears in the woods. Deathly afraid. Yes. Like, I had this experience when I was in third grade, hiking part of the Pacific Crest Trail out in the West Coast. and had really bad, it was my father, his brother, and his brother brought a friend. And that friend pretended to be a bear outside of my tent. Geez. And so the innocence of me on my very first backpacking experience, like, traumatized me at that age to the point where I was scared of the dark. I was scared of bears in the woods, always, you know, wanting to look behind me. Is anything creeping up behind? Ultimately, what I've come to learn, and there's no coincidences that the very first animal that I went out to go hunt was a black bear. I conquered my fear through that. But the point of what I want to say is that what makes life beautiful, how you said it, is it needs to have risk. We always talk about what's amazing about hunting is the unknown.
Yeah, right? That's I think we're probably kind of talking about the same thing.
Yeah.
Framing its difference, but I wildly pursue things with unknown conclusions because I want that randomness of, you know, you're never going to achieve wild results if you're doing something that's fairly safe and known. Mm-hmm. You're never gonna have the greatest experience of your life without going after it. And I tell kids, everybody is, you never know which experience is going to be the greatest experience of your life. So be at all of them. Give yourself 100% of everything you do. And like I talk to my company now, it's like, you know, we're on a good run, business is growing, we're doing all that. I say, guys, look, don't forget, in 10 years from now, these are the good old days. You know, this is it. We're creating the good old days, and we're not aware of it. So make sure to put your markers in place and realize. Because I've got a really kind of a magic group of people. The Secura team we do good business with a pretty small team, but it's just, I've run a lot of business. I mean, I'm three businesses. I've had a lot of people work for me, but I've never had a group where you always have like, you know, that he's doing good. I'm hoping he can do better. You know, we're going to have to figure, he needs some training. I got a group of people that they're all just absolute the best person for their job. And, you know, it's just, I usually have one or two of those, and I'm fortunate. We just have a really good team.
Yeah. Well, leadership makes a huge difference, right? And
I don't know what I do that does that. And it's, you know, in some ways, I own the company. I'm the CEO. I'm not part of day-to-day operations. I've got Brad. He is a COO, and he runs the company day-to-day operations. I'm the visionary, and I do, I am the marketing department and the visionary of the company. I do all the big stuff, but I think the best thing that I do for my people is listen with enthusiasm. Mm. That's the greatest, you know, the greatest gift you can give somebody is to listen. And I think so many people don't. People listen to respond. You're in an argument. The minute somebody's talking, you're formulating your response as opposed to, I'm not going to respond. I just listen to understand. And when somebody's got a problem or a problem with you, don't respond. Ask questions, only questions, you know, to make sure you understand what the issue or what's going on. You'd be surprised how, you know, you don't end up with arguments anymore. You end up with like, well, I think so. I'll repeat it. So if I understand what you're saying is boom, 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 and you feel like this, is that accurate? Or, well, I said, okay. Well, I disagree. I mean, I'll come right. I mean, whatever it is, but at least I want them to know that I took, whether it was 2 minutes or 20 minutes, to fully understand what, you know, why they think this direction for marketing is wrong, or why we're doing something a certain way. I mean, sometimes I say, you know what, let's go with it. And we'll take their idea, but it's, you got to listen. And that's not a skill that we're developing in kids, I don't think, like we used to.
Right.
I don't know.
Because it takes patience.
Yeah.
It takes time.
And it also takes commitment to the person. And the more we are relying on our phones and our tablets and our social media and those text interactions, we're losing. I mean, you see kids sitting next to each other, texting each other. You see, you know, there's all sorts of documented cases of how, you know, teenagers interact, and they can have a party and they're all sitting in chairs with their phones. They're texting each other.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like they're texting somebody else. It's, I travel a lot, and you see now when you go, like, I mean, I go to Shanghai, I'm in Vietnam, and public transportation, everybody's like this. They're all looking at a phone. And I remember at a time when people were traveling, everybody's looking around, you make eye contact, you might see somebody gesture, and all of a sudden you're having a conversation, and you're learning about culture and learning about people.
Yeah.
So
I love that. Now, you got into hunting later in life. What's your origin story of firearms? Like, were you raised by a father that put a gun in your hand? What's that origin story?
Never had firearms. It's interesting because I didn't have guns. When I was a kid, we called it Y camp, YMCA. It was a summer camp.
Yep.
And they had BB guns and twos. And I won the marksmanship competition several times. And I always had a natural ability, I guess, I really listened, understood to just kind of calm yourself and not be excited about it. And just, you know, that don't fire the gun, just lean on the trigger till the gun fires kind of stuff. So I was always kind of good at it, but I was running Greenline Data as my second company. And it was a telemarketing computer supplies to businesses. And then we had a big web component selling tape racks, data storage, cabinets, racking for companies used to have thousands of backup tapes. We had these big racking systems. And then I got into laptop storage cabinets when the HIPAA laws came out for hospitals. They had to lock up all the patient data. So I had securelaptopstorage.com, and we were a major seller of these big, fancy networked cabinets. A guy called me and said, "Can you guys store an MP5? I'm like, "Sure." I'm thinking it's a laptop. He goes, "Now, what's an MP5? He goes, "A little submachine gun." And I started laughing. I go, "Who is this?" He's with the FBI. So we talked about it for a while. I said, "You know what? Let me do a little research." And got off the phone with him. And I started doing, you know, this is before Google. This is back in the days of like Yahoo. And it wasn't as easy. But I started just, you know, looking at weapon racks. I have no idea what I'm doing. But I'm seeing references to the military. Where they're talking about how armories are failing. And there's a lot of problems. And you know, the Gulf War, you know, all that was at that time. It's 2002. And I thought, you know, maybe I can make a difference, because I was never in the military. And I called up Steve Moulton, was the owner of Dasco Data out of Canada. He made my laptop cabinets. I said, "Steve, I got a crazy idea for you. Let's make weapon racks." And he starts laughing. He goes, "Tom, I'm already working on a design for the Canadian government." I go, "You're kidding." So we compared notes, and he had the basics done. I brought in a bunch of different ideas I had, and we created it was the integrated weapon storage platform. We were a U.S. dealer, and there were some shortcomings in that system. We started selling in the military. We didn't know anything. I thought it was cool, and I wanted to help the military. And we sold for 2-3 years of just, you know, little orders here, a couple of decent orders there. And I wanted him to make changes to the racks, because the racks really weren't designed for how the U.S. military locking, the key controls. It really wasn't a good setup. Steve didn't want to change it because he was designing for the Canadian government that wanted things differently. We BS'd our way into a big contract with U.S. Army Special Forces Command. They hired us to survey their armories and write a report as to why they're failing inspections and make recommendations. We were a 3-person company. We had no idea what we were doing. And we won this contract I walked into this guy's office. I shook his hand and said, "Good morning, sir. My name's Tom Kubinek. I'm considered the leading authority in small arm storage and armory design. I really think we're the company to do this for you." We sat, talked to him for a while. We leave. I got Gary, my sales guy, with me. He got in the parking lot. He's like, "What was that?" I go, "What do you mean? Leading authority?" I said, "Gary, nobody knows how to do this. It's never been done before. We just said we're the pros from Dover. Let's win this contract." So we won the contract, and I spent 18 months on the road. I went to every single special forces, every base, every unit, every armory. I spent a day with each armor, watched his workflow, interviewed him, talked to him. I couldn't work with him because I was handling guns and stuff, but really no civilians ever had that access. And after the 18-month contract, we had a report. But during that, I designed the Secure Tactical Weapon Storage Platform, which The contract ended. We presented our weapon rack in 2009-ish. By 2011, we were the primary supplier to the U.S. military. It absolutely, completely changed the way the military stores and organizes guns. And it was in 2009, I bought my first gun. Because awesome. I'm doing this and we're getting this level of success. And we're talking about going into consumer products. Now, that was still a few years off. I said, you know what? I spent so much time in armories and in military bases. I had to look down. I knew how to walk, talk. I knew how to be like a soldier so I could have a respectful conversation with them. I said, you know what? I really got to know this stuff. So I picked up a Remington 870 shotgun, and I picked up an AR-15. I started going to the range and shooting and started getting better at it. And then I got involved in hunting. We went into consumer products in 2014. That's where I said, look, if I'm going to sell consumer products, I can't just be a hunter. I've got to be really good at this. So I started taking, I've trained with the best trainers in the country, handgun, long range precision shooting, tactical carbine classes. I've been to a lot of them. I go every chance I get, and I try to shoot and train as much as I can. I don't get as much time as I'd like just running a business, but to be authentic, if I'm going to sell high speed, fast access, there's a whole new concept in consumer gun storage. I have to be a gun expert, because in the gun safe world, there's no CEO in the gun safe world I know of that shoots. I mean, it's mostly owned by venture capital firms. And I said, if we're going to be this, we have to be firearms experts. And I don't profess to say I'm not a handgun expert by any means. I can outshoot most people probably. I'm pretty quick. I can long range shoot It's funny, I started off doing that because it's like, I've got to know how to do this just so I can walk in a room and talk to guys who are gun guys and not look like an idiot. And then you find out how much fun, I always tell my wife, it's like going to the range, you're dealing with violent explosions, shooting projectiles 100 yards into a target. Yet it is so relaxing when you're precision shooting. If I'm doing like a short range, like grouping drills, I want three shots, one hole, three shots. You're so dialed in, and the whole world melts away. Yet you're shooting a 300 wind, something that's just making with a muzzle break that's just blowing your hat off. And so I just found I absolutely loved it. And then my kids were middle school age. My wife is just. She wasn't raised with hunting up, but she's like, Tom, I want all the kids to know how to survive. I want them all to know how to get food. I want them all to know how to hunt, how to do these things. So all my kids are, my oldest lives in London now. He's economics teacher in London, and my youngest is graduating college right now. So when kids are in college, hunting's tough because college and hunting season do not match up.
Right. Right. So you went on a journey to learn how to hunt at the same time of teaching your kids how to hunt.
I'm going to say it was probably 2 years, because I had, when you've never hunted, you don't just go out and hunt. And this is one of the challenges with the hunting community is it's critically important to find the people in parties and conversations who mention it. Oh, you've never done it. And say, oh, you should. No, that's not good. You say, you know what? Have you shot a gun? But tell you what, let's go to the range on Saturday. Let's work through these things. I've got my patent attorney took his first whitetail 2 years ago at my property. And he talked about hunting. I said, well, and he said, well, I would like to get a rifle, which we talked about. He got a gun. He's shooting. And, he'd been hunting with me a few times, but he stopped my office yesterday to drop off a bunch of 6.5 Creedmoor ammo because he had done a long range precision corps class. He goes, they gave me the gun to use for the class. I don't need the rest of the ammo, but he's doing his second trip out west elk hunting. He goes, I want to take that class because I just want to be comfortable at a 400 yard shot. But he's now, again, he started hunting at 63. His whole world revolves around it.
Yeah.
He's planning all this. I mean, it's just, and it's so important to find when you talk to somebody who hasn't hunted, don't just say you should. You gotta walk, you gotta hold their hand into it. You gotta lead people into it. And so I had a friend, I was at a birthday party and I met a guy who was his wife was friends of the, whatever it was. We were talking about hunting. I said, I'd love to do it. And a couple of days later, he called me up and said, Tom, we're going to go pheasant hunting. Would you like to join us? I said, I'd love to. I go, what's best caliber for a shotgun? What do you guys do? He's a 12 gauge. Okay, yeah, I'd love to. I went out and bought my first 12 gauge. So I went pheasant hunting with a Remington pump.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Which actually is not a bad gun for, I wasn't particularly good at it, but then we went duck hunting and goose hunting. And that was my going into it. And then one of the guys, it's a group of guys, they all hunt together, had a property that was some whitetail on it. So went out whitetail hunting. And I kind of went out solo. I didn't know what I was doing. It took a while to figure that one out.
Yeah. Big game has an interesting learning curve to it.
It's amazing how many deer I have on my property and how few I see at hunting season. You know, just, and people don't realize it. Like, I've hunted in Texas a lot. My head of marketing was down in South Texas, and they're using feeders, and we're sitting in a blind, and I've got 5 8-point bucks out in the field. And he's like, those aren't shooters. I'm going, you're out of your mind. You know, it's just, and you're waiting for the big one to come in, but it's, you know, they film, he's Tejas Deer Camp. They film a lot of hunts for a lot of companies. It's not the same, man. Central New York. I was out in bow season. Early season is too warm, but I'll bet I was out 40 days straight. I never had a shot. Never. I didn't see a damn thing.
Yeah.
I saw a doe walking back to my truck. And I said, at that point, it was late in the season. I had a crossbow. I prefer to use a regular, but I had a Raven crossbow. And I just got it. I was like, all right. So I had it out. And like, all right. She saw it busted me. And then I'm walking back to the truck. I'm starting to put stuff away. And she's walking right towards me. I'm going, so I go, all right. So I got the crossbow. So I'm saying, all right. So I just kind of, I'm leaning against the door of my truck. And she walks, turns broadside. I'm like, no. I'm like, this is crazy. And the crossbow wouldn't fire. The arrow had unknocked itself a little bit. Oh. You have them locked in. And that was a new crossbow to me. So I'm like, the safety. And then she walked away. I'm just like, you know, this isn't meant to be. So,
yeah.
And then I got home and went in. I got a range at my warehouse, a little bow range. I went and figured out that I had not knocked the arrow. There's like a hard snap that I didn't get to. But, you know, you come back from a day hunting, nothing, honey. Oh, that's too bad. I said, no, I had such a good morning. I had such a good morning. So it's,
yeah. Well, that's a great segue into my next question is, you know, you've had a lot of life experiences. You've experienced and done a lot, but what has hunting done for you?
What has hunting done for me? I think it brings you peace. It brings you, there's so much purpose because, you know, I've got a 500 acre property and that it's heavily wooded. It takes a lot of maintenance, trails and stuff to have a good hunting property. So in summers, I'm usually up around 4 o'clock in the morning. In the winter, I build cars from, you know, 5 o'clock till 8 o'clock. I'm building car every morning. That's my therapy. In the summer, I am now, and I never did this before. And now in the summer, I've got a little excavator. I've got a tractor. I've got various equipment. I'm up on the property, improving trails, trimming trees, you know, mowing fields. And I tell my wife, I said, honey, if I'm ever reincarnated, in another life, I'm a farmer. There's no greater feeling than the sun coming up, that smell of fresh cut grass, or you're taking some trees out with a chainsaw, and I'm getting pretty good at it. And you're making, you come back and you look at the trail you made. It's just like, working land is so fulfilling, and I have no reason to do it.
Yeah.
Nobody needs me to do this. It's that connection. And I'm improving the property, and we're putting our land in a development trust with New York State so it can never be built. I've cut out one little corner. I got 4 acres where I'm building a cabin, but the rest of the property this should be going through pretty soon. So we're going to have it it's going to be the largest land trust property in central New York that anybody's ever donated. So we're going to do that and just, because it is absolutely spectacular land.
Oh, that's awesome.
So awesome. So that's, I don't know how you tangibly say, what's it do for you? Because it's, it's almost too personal to even understand it. I'm not sure what it does for me, but I'm drawn to it every morning. And then I come in at 8 o'clock, about 8:30, maybe nine, maybe 9 o'clock meeting. Sometimes I do the meeting on a tractor and then I jump in. I'm usually to the office by 9:30, 10 o'clock. And my day is so good. You have such good days when you start off getting so much physical work done.
Yeah. Yeah.
The rest of the day is just easy.
I agree. I love it. I love you sharing your perspective, Tom. Really appreciate it. It's it's quite amazing stories to hear. And I love, you know, I've asked that question to a lot of guests. You know, we've done over 360 plus episodes of the podcast. And when I ask people that, they always pause. And I was like, whoa, I've never really thought of it like that.
Yeah.
And I love how you say it's hard to put into words.
Oh, yeah.
Because,
well, language is so limiting.
Yeah.
It's all we have. We're stuck with just these words, and it's hard to convey meaning sometimes. Yeah. You try. But you're talking to your wife, and you just don't understand me. No, I don't.
Yep.
It's because I can't, because we're using words.
Yeah. That's why when it comes to the defense of hunting, it's so important to have anecdotal evidence. Yeah. That experience to show how it roots in all aspects of our life. Yeah. And that is where we need to stand up for wildlife and wild places, and to be able to actively manage and conserve for future generations.
Yeah.
I really appreciate you coming on. Thanks for sharing your history, your stories, your journey. Secure It Tactical. I mean, that's pretty phenomenal. Great job with that.
It's going well. It's been a really good ride.
I love it. What hunts do you have planned for this coming year? Do you have anything that's on?
I've never done it. It's an attorney in Syracuse. He met me at SHOT Show, and we're going on a big turkey hunt this spring up in the Adirondacks. I want to do another elk trip out west. My scheduling, unfortunately for me, is business wise, that September, October time is we're busy. It's a real hard time for me to get away. So I've got to do some figuring on that one. And then getting the cabin, I want to start construction in about 2 months on the cabin. It's going to it'll take over a year to build. But I've got my big plan, I guess, this season is it's a heavily wooded property. Most of my shots on deer are 60 yards. So I'm taking a lot of trees out in one area, putting in some stands to cover. I want to cover about a 500 yard shot. Cool. I love the long range shoot, and I'm dead nuts confident if I've got my rifle to 600 yards. I'll shoot a clay at 1,000 yards with my rifle. If I get the dope on the gun, I can make the shot, but I want to set up some longer where I'm not always in the trees up close, but where I can sit and I've got scope. I've got close, but I've got long distance where you're scanning the land.
Yeah.
I love the concept of deer sniper. Or I like to still hunt a lot where I'm walking. The whole stalking thing with whitetail is so hard.
Yeah.
And that's just, I love doing that because you're going so slow. You think you're not going to get anywhere, but.
Yeah. That's beautiful. That's beautiful. Well, brother, thanks for coming on the show. Thanks for sharing your passion.
Certainly.
For life. I love you talking about vision, staying in the groove, diving into that. For all you listeners, go check out everything that Tom has going on at his company is secureittactical.com. Really cool. But Tom, how can other people connect with you if they want to hear more about you?
You know, if you Google my name and it's spelled weird, I'm like the only, I've got a nephew, but there's only one Kubinick family in the world, and I'm all over the web. The retail site is secureitgunstorage.com. We get the military site retail, but I'm the CEO that takes phone calls, that talks to people. That's the greatest thing I can do, is talk to people for my business. So if anybody reaches out, I am very accessible online.
Cool.
And I respond to most people that reach out to me.
I love it. I love it. Well, guys, I hope you enjoyed this episode. I hope you picked up something on it that you're going to be able to apply in your own life. Remember, iron sharpens iron, and so the countenance of one friend to another. And when we spend time evaluating how we've done things in the past, it allows us to set our compass so that we know where we're going in the future. Because without vision, the people perish. And it's very important that we always keep sight on our goals, our targets, and what we want in this world. Remember that hunting has the power to transform lives through primal adventure, and that you can never outgive good, as mentorship is conservation. For Tom Kubenick and Johnny Mack here at Soul Seekers, be blessed, freedom on, and as always, stay soulful.
If you enjoyed today's podcast and want to support the show, you can always like, share, subscribe, and leave a rating, as it helps us share our mission of mentorship is conservation. Thank you so much for tuning in and being a part of Soul Seekers Nation as we transform lives through primal adventure.